is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Coach Corey Harris from the Beijing Royal Fighters CBA team, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast. Let's get into it.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new FastDraw and FastScout. FastDraw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years, and now with its integrated web platform, coaches have the ability to add video to plays and share them directly to their players' Android and iPhones via their mobile app. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. In addition to a great product, they also provide basketball coaching content and resources through their blog and playbank. For access to these plays and more information, visit fastmodelsports.com or follow them on Twitter at fastmodel.
We're able to coach them hard on the court because they know we love them hard off the court.
Terrence Munch Williams has been the executive director of Pro Scholars Athletics since 2008. Williams attended and graduated from the Holderness School, a selective boarding school in New Hampshire. Terrence holds a bachelor's degree in sociology from Wesleyan University in 2002. After graduating from Wesleyan, Terrence served 2 years in the Teach for America program and went on to teach first grade for 3 years in a school located in New York City's South Bronx. After teaching, he spent 2 years as dean of students at East New York Preparatory Charter School and earned a master's in education/building leadership at the University of Phoenix during this time. It was at this point that Terrence decided to return to his roots and accepted a position as educational coordinator of the SCAN Reach for the Stars program at Mullally Recreation Center, a program he participated in as a child. Within a year and a half of returning to SCAN, Terrence was promoted to center director of the Mullally Recreation Center. While returning to the SCAN organization, he began working with the initial group of students who would help create the foundation for the Pro Scholars Athletic Program. Under his leadership, Pro Scholars Athletics has grown from one team of a handful of after-school students to a basketball program recognized as the top men's basketball AAU program in the country. Understanding that team sports can be a springboard to numerous academic and social opportunities, Williams has spearheaded an educational movement that has seen student-athletes earn admission to prestigious boarding and Catholic schools located throughout the Northeast, as well as numerous Division I scholarship offers for its participants. We recently launched the Hoopheads Mentorship Program. We believe that having a mentor is the best way to maximize your potential and become a transformational coach. By matching you up with one of our experienced mentors, you'll develop a one-on-one relationship that will help your coaching, your team, your program, and your mindset. The Hoopheads Mentorship Program delivers mentoring services to basketball coaches at all levels through our team of experienced head coaches. Find out more at hoopheadspod.com or shoot me an email directly, mike@hoopheadspod.com. Our roster of shows is growing, so don't forget to check out all our other podcasts on the Hoopheads Pod Network, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, Players Court, Bleachers and Boards, and our team-focused NBA podcasts, Cavaliers Central, Grizz and Grind, Knuck If You Buck, The 305 Culture, Blazing the Path, Hashtag Lakers, Motor City Hoops, X's and O's NBA Breakdown, Spanning the Spurs, The LA Hoops Pod, and coming soon, Thunderous Applause. We're looking for more NBA podcasters interested in hosting their own show centered on a particular team. Email us info@hoopheadspod.com if you're interested in learning more and bringing your talent to our network. Grab your notebook before you listen to this episode with Terrence Munch Williams, director of the PSA Cardinals AAU program in the Bronx, New York.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Terrence Munch Williams, the executive director of the PSA Cardinals AAU basketball program. Terrence, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Thank you guys for having me. Pleasure's all mine. Looking forward to being on the podcast.
We are excited to have you on, be able to dig into all the great things that you've been able to do in the game of basketball and outside of the game of basketball. You have a lot of interesting things on your resume. So let's start out by going back in time to when you were a kid. Just give us an idea of what your athletic background was as a kid, what sports you played, how you got into the game of basketball, and we'll just kind of take it from there.
Yeah, I mean, young age, you're running around, you're doing a bunch of sports, baseball, football, basketball, soccer, whatever you get yourself into to stay out of trouble. Growing up in the Bronx and in New York City and the inner city and in the heart of the ghetto. So we were just doing everything, you know, from kick the can to any sport that we could think of as youth. And then kind of, you know, I settled into the basketball sport kind of based around the finances that came with that particular sport. It was cheaper.
You needed some shorts and a pair of tennis shoes, right? You were good to go.
Yeah, you basically needed whatever you were wearing that day, and you walked to the park and you started running around. Whoever had the basketball, it was pretty much a free opportunity. And my mom was like, "Look, I can't afford that, all the rest of those sports that you're thinking about, so start making that your home, the basketball court in the park." So that was when I kind of picked it up at like 12, 13, and never looked back, to be honest with you.
What was the playground basketball scene like in the Bronx while you were growing up?
It was good. I mean, you at that time, everything was about, you know, the street ball, the coming outside in the park and trying to find a way to win and stay on the court. And if you lose, you have to wait 6 or 7 games. You know, young guys trying to play with the older guys trying to bully you and send you to the little kid court. And then the way we kind of operated was, it was, you know, the guys who played together was based on your neighborhood. So you would come to the park with like 5 or 6 of your friends, and all these different locations of neighborhoods would show up to that same location, and we would kind of battle it out. But it was, you know, it was good bonding, good friendships, but those games were wars. You know, they were, you didn't want to lose because you just didn't want to get off the court because you had nothing else to do for the rest of the day. You know, so we spent a lot of time outside in that park. It was walking distance from our apartment building, so your parents never had to worry about where you were, and you know, you got all the exercise you could possibly have. I mean, we played from sun up to sundown, literally. And drink out the water fountain and continued on blood, sweat, and tears. So it was beautiful, to be honest.
Did you ever get an opportunity to get court time by yourself where you could kind of work on your game, or was working on your game limited to just playing pickup basketball?
Yeah, man. Like when I was a kid, we never did that. We never did the cones. We never did the trainers. We never did any of that. Like, you got better playing competition, like competitive competition, older guys. Like, what? It could be a 25-year-old going against a 15-year-old. Like, it never registered to us that age was mattered, or, you know, you never spent time trying to perfect your craft, or everything happened off of natural instincts. Like, you learn how to take bumps, you learn how to finish layups, you learn how to take floaters because you're playing older guys, and you learn how to pass and defend, you know, stronger guys, just because everything came down to the same thing. You win, you stay on, you lose, you are literally lost without anything to do for fun. So we didn't grow up with the things that the guys have now.
So when you think about the differences in the two systems, and I didn't grow up in New York City, I grew up in Cleveland in a suburb, but I was always kind of like you in terms of looking for games and trying to find the best games in the city and driving around and always searching out and being able to play and just do those kinds of things. And obviously, as you said, kids today don't do that. They don't have those same opportunities to play against older players who kind of teach them the tricks of the trade. And you got to learn how to use your body, and you got to know how to bump, and you got to know how to do this and do that, that some of those older players teach you. Whereas today, kids grow up in the gym with mom and dad watching, or with a trainer there with them, with a scoreboard. And so there's something I think that is missing from the game of basketball in terms of players' development that kids that grew up in the way that you and I did had that kids today don't have. So when you're looking about, when you're thinking about your PSA Cardinal program, how do you try to instill or incorporate aspects of that, what you think are the positives that you took away from playground basketball? Is there any way that you can try to incorporate that or anything that you do to maybe help those kids that are part of your program maintain that competitive spirit? Because I think that's one of the things that you always hear about, you know, when you have people that knock AAU, they say, ah, there's playing so many games and winning just isn't as important. So how do you try to get that message across to the kids that are part of your program that was just something that you picked up naturally?
Yeah, well, first of all, we do quality over quantity when it comes down to our schedule. So the myth is that, oh, you guys are playing 85 games a year, when the reality is we're probably playing 20 to 25, maybe 30, right, at the high school level. So everything that we do is in a competitive environment as far as the games are concerned. And then with the EYBL being structured the way it is, every single game counts towards your record. So it's kind of like an NBA schedule where you play, you know, you get to a city and you play four or five games, you get to another city in a couple of weeks and you play another four or five games, all in trying to win a certain amount of games and come in, you know, the top four or five in your conference in order to qualify for the Peace Jam, which is the equivalent of like the NBA playoffs. So we're teaching our guys to love winning. We're teaching them how to be competitive and not just jump on the basketball court for any and everything. Like we don't just run around doing 100 games. Then from the practice standpoint, all of our drills, all of our components to our workout, the way we design our practices are extremely competitive, where there's consequences for not performing well, or there's consequences for not making something happen in a certain amount of time. It's structured as far as, you know, everything is on the time restraint. From any drill, from any shots, from any workouts, there's always some type of like goal orientated. So we're trying to build competitive guys within our practice structure. And then we practice for a long period of time. We practice 5 hours on a Saturday and 5 hours on a Sunday. So it's 2 hours on, 1 hour off, and 2 hours back on. And we're trying to build those guys' bodies and, you know, make sure that they could perform while they're fatigued. And, you know, that's the equivalent of what we did when we was younger. We would be in the park for a lot of hours and try to concentrate and focus when you're tired and, you know, 3 hours in, you're still trying to stay on the court. And it's kind of similar to our practices where, you know, you can be going for 2.5, 3 hours. And then the third hour, we're going into shell drills and defensive rotations and box outs and diving on the floor for loose balls. So it kind of leads into each other. But we just try to get guys who honestly are at least somewhat naturally competitive and hate losing. And then we try to put them in environments where they have to compete in practice and then in games.
I think by setting it up the way you just described and putting kids in those positions where you put, quote, pressure on them to be able to perform when they're tired, and obviously when you have the level of teams that you've been able to put together and the quality of players that you've been able to have, then you're putting those kids into situations where maybe they haven't been in those situations before, competing against other great players who are part of their team. Because let's face it, when you're on your high school team and you're on the level of some of the guys that you've been able to have as part of your program, those kids are clearly far and away the best player on their high school team. And so they kind of naturally become the leader of that high school team, the ball's in their hands all the time. And then they come and they play AAU basketball with you. And now suddenly they might just be one guy of 12 and you got to kind of find your place. So talk about how you maybe help kids to adjust to that mentally, that change from being the man to being a guy who maybe has to fit in a little bit more and find out what their role is to be able to help the team be successful.
Yeah. I mean, we're fortunate, right? Well, we've already placed about 82 guys in Division I in the last like 8 years. So we come with a certain pedigree for guys being able to get to the next level. And in doing so, we try to develop and structure our entire program in somewhat of a college bubble where we design things where everything is done from that fashion. So we find guys who understand that they need to play with other talent. We find guys who want to win. We find guys who want to share. We develop those guys year in and year out, you know, as they're moving up the ladder from one grade to the next. But we put winning at a premium. We put competitiveness, team orientated goals in the forefront. We discuss individual goals before we get on the court, and we discuss team goals, and we try to align those two entities into one. And then most importantly, we explain each person's role from that team's perspective and break it down and say, hey, listen, you might have been the guy taking the most shots on your high school team, but here we need you to limit those shots because this other guy's here, and you know, this other big guy is going to be the guy who blocks shots and rebounds and runs the floor, and this other guy is going to be the defender. And we kind of get you get your roles on the team, and you try to master those roles because it all equals winning. And if you win, you're going to get a chance to play in front of more college coaches. And if you win, you're going to get a chance to get more scholarships. And if you win, you're going to get more exposure and more rankings and more camps and all of the things that they're gunning for. It all comes back to winning, and we can't win if everyone is just, you know, on an individual court. So we try to do things from a team concept. We do a lot of team building. We do a lot of like going out to museums and going out to the movies and going to church together and doing community service together and doing group texts and just anything and everything that can lead to those guys having some type of camaraderie. One of the things that we do that's a little different than most programs is on the weekends, our guys giving their cell phones for the entire weekend. So the cell phones are in the drawer. And then those guys are able to eat lunch together, eat breakfast together, eat dinner together, communicate in the hotel room, do study hall, communicate on the van ride, communicate on the flight, communicate in the lobby, just everything that has to do with building these guys to be friends and getting to know each other. And now we up to the part where we're doing, you know, investment banking classes and talking about real estate, just all these different things on the road. So it's a different type of structure, but it all comes down to having unselfish guys that get, and families, honestly, that get the big picture to what we're trying to accomplish. And the why has been the same why for a long period of time, which is, you know, let's get everybody to school for free.
Do you know where to hit the backboard for the highest percentage shots? Do you know when using the backboard is better than taking a direct shot? Be certain that you are taking the highest percentage shots by training with the Shoticle. The Shoticle mounts on your backboard to give you the location of the highest percentage shots. Train with the Shoticle and you will score more. Basketball is a data-driven game, so don't ignore the data and the facts. We worry about the data so you can focus on shooting. Visit Shoticle.com now and start scoring more.
All right, so let's work backwards here. And now that you've had your program established and clearly you've had a tremendous amount of success, and as you mentioned, the number of guys that you've been able to send on to Division I, that kind of feeds on itself where people now know your reputation and they know what you're all about. But I imagine that when you started, that wasn't the case. And you had to do a lot more selling of you and selling of your program in order to get it to the point where it is now and where you can do the things that you just described. And people are almost already bought in before they even set foot in the door because your reputation precedes you. So take us back to when you first started. What was the genesis of starting the AAU program? Just think back to that time when it first began. What was your vision at the time? And then how did you go about trying to make that vision a reality?
Yeah, I mean, it was a beautiful grind. I mean, it was literally trying to like put a seed in the ground and water the flower and hope the sun come out and build from the bottom. I mean, there was no rush, there was no pressure, there was strictly some young men at the age of about 12, sixth graders that were in the after school program I was running, and I was a director of the center, and it was really like a somewhat of a gimmick where it's like, hey, listen, come to the after school program, do your homework, get your tutoring on, you know, get do these classes. And then at 6 o'clock, you know, we'll put you guys through some workouts, and kind of just built from that, where it was like, okay, I trust that. And, you know, the guys would come in every single day, and, you know, Monday through Friday, we would do the same structure, feed those guys, make sure they did their homework, make sure they did their classes. And then 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., we would put them through drills and we would work them out and we'd teach them the game. And then we started playing on the weekends and local events, you know, whether it's just around the city in Harlem, Queens, Manhattan, the Bronx. We made those guys, and we allowed them to connect their academics with their athletics. And we did that for like 2 years, and we did a ton of winning in the local area, right? And then we started to branch out with the same guys. They moved up to seventh grade, and we added maybe one kid or two kids, and kept it real small, mom and pop. Had the right staff, and we spent a lot of time with those guys. You know, we were doing weightlifting, we were doing track workouts, we were running stairs, we were doing stations, we were doing study hall together, we was just doing everything. We had summer jobs, and, you know, everything you could think of, we had those guys all year round in a facility that we touched them every single day. So academically, we knew where they were. Socially, we knew where they were. And athletically, we knew where they were. So we had some really good gauges on them. And then we started playing in like New Jersey or Philadelphia and smaller AAU events in like seventh grade. And we started winning there. And then, you know, we kept winning. And, you know, the team got to like eighth grade and then ninth grade. And, you know, we were doing a lot of fundraising, a lot of car washes and scratch off cards, just everything you could think of to continue to keep it going, right? And the kids were doing great. They were going to really good academic schools. We were getting kids into prep schools at an early age, at like seventh grade. You know, the parents were great. They was super supportive, and you know, we were traveling around in like one of the parents' cars, and you know, a couple of the coaches' cars, and we were just making it happen at the end of the day. And, you know, one thing led to another. And then Nike came into play, I think, when those guys, that was like the 2014 class. I think when those guys were in like maybe 10th grade, we became like one of the, I guess, the number one team in the country, according to some polls, for a couple of years. And then got the Nike sponsorship, and kind of like, you know, it is what it is today.
All right. So one of the things that has kind of been a theme through what you've said, and it may be something that our audience isn't aware of, is you kept talking about some of the offerings that you have for your kids and the things that you have available to them that are not strictly basketball related. And so I think that ties in really well with your own background. So let's go back in time to when you're in high school. Just give us a little bit of your background as a student, and then kind of what your goals were when you went to college. And then obviously you came out and went into Teach for America. So just kind of give us the rundown of your academic career, and then how that played into ultimately what your vision was for what you ended up doing as this thing came together on the AAU front.
Yeah, so I'll just jump right to high school. Like, I went to Taft High School in the Bronx, which was at that time considered one of the worst public schools in New York City, at minimum, probably in the country. I graduated there in 4 years. I was just an average student, loved basketball. Spent a ton of time just doing that and getting good enough grades to continue to matriculate up the ladder. Then when it became time to graduate, I had a mentor named Marsha Scipio, who ran the SCAN Reach for the Stars program, which is like your local Boys and Girls Club. And I was a part of that program. And she, when it came time for me to pick a college, she was like, listen, I don't think that you're ready for college academically. And I'm like, what are you talking about? I just passed all my classes for 4 years. Like, I got a diploma saying I'm ready, you know, and I have options. Like, I can go to school. So she's like, listen, you're not ready. We should do this boarding school. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She was like, there's a boarding school called Holdenish School in New Hampshire. Right. And I'm like, Holdenish School? I'm like, New Hampshire. So so long story short, I trusted her. Basically, you know, that's the fork in the road that changed my entire life, to be honest, academically. So I go to Holdenish School, but the trick to it was I didn't realize that they put me back in the 11th grade when I got there. So they made me like repeat two grades. So when most people are thinking, hey, reclass, you do a year over or post-grad, I didn't realize they were sending me back to 11th grade until I'm like fully invested in the classes. And she's like, yeah, you in 11th grade because you needed just your foundation to be fixed academically. Because at the end of the day, I was passing classes, but I didn't take school serious whatsoever. So when I got to that place, it was small. It was about 250 students, co-ed, majority Caucasians, probably like 5 black kids in the entire school at the time, 2-3 black staff members. But basketball wasn't that good. You know, I'm coming in from the city of New York to the first day there, I'm canoeing and going camping. I'm like, what the hell are we doing here? This is crazy, right? So, but it's at that place where I learned how to be competitive academically, because it was a small class setting. It was like 12 kids there, you know, teacher, small group, around the clock tutoring, real hands-on, everything from chapel to dress code. It was like, honestly, just a whole new world. The first week I called home, you know, and I'm like, hey, I'm talking to my brother. I'm like, hey, I'm ready to come home. And he's like, well, what are you coming home to? There's nothing. Like at that time, reality is I'm sleeping on two chairs in my mom's living room, in the Bronx. Like there's nothing for me to come home to. Like we're on welfare. My sister's at the apartment with a newborn baby. And my brother's like, listen, I don't know where you're coming, but it's nothing here. You need to figure it out. And I called my mentor and she's like, look, I don't know how you're going to get home because I'm not coming to get you. It's 7 hours away. So needless to say, you know, 2 years, I get in there and I learned how to become competitive academically. Like the basketball was at that point, it just became whatever to me. Like I was in there and I was passing time. And, you know, obviously I loved the game, but I started to yearn, you know, knowledge and academia and what I can do with it and reading and remembering things and comprehending what I'm reading and just learning, you know, structures and study habits. And everything was such a rigid thing where everything was time sensitive and you had to put your best foot forward in that realm as opposed to the sports. Like sports came easy to me. I was playing like football and, you know, running track and doing a bunch of stuff. It wasn't that complicated to me, but the academics is where I kind of was, you know, I had something to prove. So fast forward, you know, I graduate from Holden as probably like a B+ student, on the road kid. I bust my tail in there and then I ended up getting accepted to Wesleyan University, in Middletown, Connecticut. You know, they recruited me and, you know, my mentor was like, hey, this is big time. You should go there. You know, it's kind of like a little Yale. And honestly speaking, I didn't realize how academically respected it was at the time. And when I got in, I just remember a bunch of kids coming up to me saying, damn, like you got into that place. And that's where I really, really wanted to go since I was 10 and you got in. So went over to Wesleyan, played 3 years. My last year, I decided not to play because I really wanted to focus on getting a job. And one of the things I didn't want to do is, you know, become that guy that did all this and it ended up back in the neighborhood with nothing to show for it. So my last year, I was like, look, I'm going to spend my time trying to figure out what I'm doing when I come out of this place, because I'm not going back to the hood with nothing. You know, my family's not structured in that manner where there's a job waiting for me. So I ended up doing applying for like Teach for America. And then, you know, you go through the process and I got in. And once again, by the grace of God, a bunch of people were like, wow, that's really hard to get into. And I was able to come back to New York City. To do the training. And then I ended up teaching like first grade in, you know, in a community that I kind of knew from the neighborhood that I grew up in. So now I'm coming back and I'm looking like somewhat of a hero because I'm, you know, I've already graduated from college, from prep school. You know, now I got a good job and, you know, I'm in grad school at Pace at night. I'm coaching. I'm just doing a bunch of things that are all positive, you know? So that's kind of where it starts at. And then, you know, the academic stuff, I took it serious once I got to Holden in school. And I learned the difference between, you know, the education that I was able to get from being a kid from the Bronx, that was like a public school, my neighborhood, and the education that I was able to obtain from being at Holden is in pretty much the same age range, right? Like when I was at Taft, 16, 17, 18 years old, same thing at Holden is, those guys were that age. But what they were able to capture and afford and resources that they had was completely different than what I had when I was young. So we tried to kind of move that into to what we do on a daily basis. And I say that from the standpoint of just giving guys different opportunities to let them see that, you have the choice to go to public school. You have the choice to go to private school. You have the choice to go to boarding school. There's a lot of different opportunities that your family can have and can stretch your network base and can stretch your education level and things of that nature. You don't have to limit yourself just to what you see because you don't know about this other stuff. So we were able to walk them through that introduction of these other opportunities from boarding schools in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts and, you know, Delaware, just up and down the Northeast. We kind of was able to open that door. So now we have a ton of guys in our program that go to boarding schools, and we have some guys that go to Catholic schools and a couple guys that go to public school. So our framework has always been from the academics leading into the athletics.
Hey, hoopheads, we all hate ankle sprains, and they happen way too often. Ankle injuries are the number one sports-related injury. Arise is trying to change that. With the iFast, your athletes get preventative protection and full mobility. Athletes no longer need to wear bulky braces that limit performance and give mediocre protection. Anyone playing sports should be using these products. Keep your athletes in the game. Don't wait for them to get hurt to take action. Visit www.arise.com, spelled A-R-Y-S-E, and use the code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off the future of performance. That's A-R-Y-S-E.com with promo code HOOPHEADS to get 20% off.
So do you think that when you first started taking academics seriously and then you get done and you apply to be part of Teach for America, did you always have it in your mind that for your career, as you started looking at what your options were when you graduated, that working with kids or being in education or being in coaching was what you wanted to do? Or did you have maybe something else long-term in mind? Because typically when you think of Teach for America, that's, isn't it usually a 2-year program or a 3-year program? And then then you could transition and do something else. Obviously you didn't necessarily have a teaching degree when you did that. So just maybe explain what your mindset was in terms of, was that a long-term play that you knew that you were going to end up with working in education and sports with kids, or was it something that you're like, I want to try this, challenge myself, and then you had something else in mind back when you first started?
Yeah, I always knew that I was really good with kids, and I loved basketball. Like, those two things, I knew somehow, some way they need to connect. When I did the Teach for America, when I learned, like, hey, a lot of people are doing this program, and it's a bad setup from the standpoint of you're taking the least experienced people, right, in that field in teaching and putting them in the most desperate situations that these kids are in. So a lot of times people were just doing the 2 years to get the master's paid for and then moving on, right, to a different profession, or coming from being a lawyer into doing that, getting a master's and leaving. I was steadfast in saying, hey, listen, I'm not going to leave these kids after the 2 years. There was a certain level of guilt for me because me being a rookie in that field, I was kind of like behind. So these kids, I was affecting their education. I was teaching first grade. So like, you got a kid in the first grade, this is the beginning of the academic life, and you don't know what you're doing just yet, right? So the beginning, first year, I'm a rookie. There's a rookie second grade teacher. There's a rookie third grade teacher. And I'm saying to myself, wow, what if this kid went from me to her to him? He's only going to get half his education because we're all learning on the fly, right? So it didn't become all about the masses. For me, it became really about just, hey, I'm a black man in the heart of the Bronx. And sometimes for these kids, that's the first time they see a positive black man in their life as a role model, right? Their teacher. For some of them, you know, their dads are not home, or for others, it's just like, you know, I can be somebody, look at him, right? Because I look just like them, right? Like, there's weekdays where I'm dressing down and wearing the stuff that they want to wear. So I think for me, it was always just get your feet wet. And then once I learned, like, hey, you can really affect people's lives, I was doing the teaching and then I was doing the AAU stuff simultaneously. I mean, it's tiring, but I'm affecting a ton of kids at one, you know, in one lump sum. So I didn't think that, you know, I didn't know I wanted to be a teacher going into undergrad, or I didn't know how long I wanted to stay in teaching when I was getting my master's. But I knew that I didn't want to be just like the typical Teach for America guy, come in for 2 years, reap the benefits, and then walk away from these kids, right? Because there just wasn't a lot of guys that look like me in that building or in those buildings. So I kind of owed it to them, and I got better. And once I got better at it, I'm like, oh, no, I could really affect these kids. Like, I could take a kid from a first grade level to a third grade level in a year because I know that the discipline that they need, and I'm them. Like, I know what it's like to go home and there's no lights on, or go home and there's no one there to sit with you to do your homework. So I was designing a bunch of different ways for them to get things done in advance where they didn't have to worry about mom or dad helping them when they got home or having them come early to school to get certain tutoring done. Like, I eliminated all of the excuses that they would have being kids from the inner city, because my story was worse than theirs. Like, I've been homeless. I've lived in shelters. I've lived in crack infested buildings and everything that you can think of. It was worse than their situation. And when I told them my story, they were like, okay, Mr. Williams, whatever you want us to do, let's do it. And it's the same thing now with the PSA guys. Like, your story's not worse than mine. So if I'm here today, then you can actually do better than me.
All right, let's zoom out for a second, big picture, because I think what you just described, when we start thinking about how we can have an impact on, because both Jason and I are teachers. So I teach right now. I taught third grade for a long time. I taught fifth grade for 14 years. Now I'm teaching K to six phys ed, and Jason's taught fourth grade, and now he's teaching eighth grade math. So we're right there with you in terms of being, you know, educators. I've been doing it for 20 some odd years, whatever.
This is year 11 for me, Mike.
All right,
year 11 for me.
You're getting old, Jason. So I think one of the things that, you know, we always talk about, and that, you know, you hear talked about in education all the time, is, you know, how can we close that achievement gap? How can we make certain that the kids that need, as you said, I thought one of the interesting points that you made was, you know, here they throw me in there in the worst possible environment with kids who are in desperate need of having not a beginning, new, not sure what he's doing teacher, but those people, you know, those kids need the best teachers in front of them to be able to lift them out of the situation that they're in. So if you look at the big picture, do you think that what you did is the way that it has to be done in order to affect change? In other words, I think it has to be almost one person at a time with the type of passion and the type of story that you brought to the table to be able to impact. And to me, it comes down to more of that one-to-one, just look, I'm determined to be able to help these kids. Cause I think a lot of times we hear about these big sweeping educational reforms that don't go anywhere. And I think your story, as I'm sitting there listening to you tell it, to me, that's just a story of like one guy saying, I might not be able to change 10,000 lives, but I might be able to change 50 through what I'm doing. And to me, I think that's where you really start to see change, when there's people that invest. Again, you went back and were fortunate to be able to invest in the community where you started. And that to me is powerful.
Yeah.
So when you think about that, and you go and you look at your time in the classroom, and what do you think was the most impactful piece of what you were able to bring every day? Do you think it was the fact that the kids could see themselves in you?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you're starting at a young age, right? Like, you can get them before those deficiencies kick in. Like, you guys are taught fourth grade, fifth grade. Like, there's a high probability that kids in the fifth grade is on the third grade reading level, right?
Right.
Or there's always those stories. Like, for me, I was able to put them on the right. Once I was good at it and I understood the ins and outs, I was able to put them on either the equal track or even further along, in case the next teacher that they went to wasn't as passionate as I was, or didn't have that same why, or didn't have the same connection to the kid. So a kid can walk up to you and be in the mid-second grade level in September. You know what I mean? So I think having that desire to just make sure that they weren't behind when they went to the next step, or they were ahead in case some things went left in their life. But they tell you, like, I think it's, if you don't know how to read by the third grade, it might be completely over for you, right? So me having these guys and these young ladies at a young age, I made education fun for them. Like, we had structure and obviously procedures to everything that went on in the classroom, but we made learning fun. And that's the time when they're sponges, where everything for them is just about, you know, I can learn anything. Like, it's magical for them in their minds, because they don't know anything. They're starting from scratch, right? And now you're teaching them multiplication in the first grade, and double digit multiplication and division and all these things that they're going to learn, you know, at the next grade. And I'm telling them, hey, listen, we're going to do some second grade stuff now, or we're going to do some third grade stuff now. And they're excited because they just want to keep learning new things. So I think I gave them somewhat of that fire at an early age to say learning is cool, and being smart is the new thing, it's the new wave. And, you know, but ultimately, you know, for the parents, they looked at me like, wow, this is the same dude that I see, you know, at the corner store. This is the same dude I see coaching kids on the weekend. This is the same, like, this dude is dedicated to my kid. My kid can relate to him, you know. And then for the kids, it's literally like, I mean, at what age as a young black kid in the ghetto sometimes see a positive black role model that can take you to 10, 11, 12 years old, you know, sometimes longer than that. So I was able to say, okay, I got to be on point. And it kept me structured, honestly, like away from work and away from coaching. I always knew that I couldn't mess up because you're in a profession that requires you to be on point. So these kids are seeing, I think that's the biggest thing. They're seeing someone that resembles something different in the neighborhood drug dealer or the neighborhood gangster or whatever it is when you're trying to get walk in the front of your building. You know, like, my teacher looks like these guys, but he's different. And it's okay to be like that. It's okay to wear a tie, you know?
Do you think that translates in the same way to what you're doing with the AAU stuff? And you start talking about having classes in real estate and having classes in investing in the stock market and having classes in personal finance and being able to teach kids something beyond just what they're going to learn from you on the basketball court. Do you think that same feeling of being a role model, or that same way that those kids who, yeah, they're not in first grade anymore, maybe they're 13, 14, 15 when you're seeing them for the first time, but do you still feel like that same power that you have to be an inspiration, to be a role model, do you still feel like that same thing enables you to have an impact on those kids and their families, even though they're at a little bit older age?
Yeah, I think it's even bigger now, because, like, our mantra is own your destiny, which is control your faith. Don't allow somebody to put you in a box. Be a boss in your own right. And I think what those guys see is a bunch of black males that they're dealing with on a daily basis in this program that are pushing them to be all that they can be. You know what I mean? Like, not allow any limits to your growth. There's no ceiling. On the court, there's no ceiling off the court. There's free space to try new things, whether it's poetry, whether it's being a violinist, whether it's, you know, being a pastor, just different things that you might be into. We give you that freedom to try it along with your basketball talent. You want to be into photography, bring your camera with you on the road. So I think when these guys looking at, I'm kind of like, in the entire staff, we're kind of those guys, lawyers, like they're Johnny Cochran's to be able to protect them from the world and allow them to challenge themselves in different ways outside of just the basketball. And it's weird, because as I go forward, I see things that I'm like, wow, like, I didn't realize they were watching me to that capacity. Like, I see guys get older and start, you know, wearing stuff that I was wearing, you know, 5 years ago or 3 years ago. Like, you know, I have this thing where I like Gucci, right? And the guys who make the NBA, the next thing I know, they're wearing Gucci and they're teasing me because, you know, when they didn't have the funds to get it, it probably was something they was idolizing, right? But they also know that it comes with hard work. It comes with dedication. It comes with, you know, this innate desire to be great and to be the best at something. So everything that we're doing as the leaders of the program, we do take the understanding that they're watching every move we make, and we need to be as best we can possibly be every chance we get, which is why you don't see me on social media or anything like that to showcase anything negative. So I think what I'm doing is similar now, but it's at a higher level. Like, you're talking to kids about balancing their bank books, and you're talking about, like, you know, the younger guys, we probably was the first ones to buy them a wallet and try to teach them how that symbolizes manhood. And, you know, we're talking about teaching guys how to wear a tie, and they're teaching other guys how to wear a tie, and just to be, you know, to be selfless and do these community service projects in your community and how to give back. So it's a lot of different layers to it. But the simplest thing is to know that you're a role model and not a basketball coach. Like, I tell people all the time, like, I deal with these guys 12 months a year, 365 days, right? I coach 25 to 30 games. I don't think I'm a basketball coach at this point.
All right. So my question that goes along with that is, you've mentioned a couple times your staff. So clearly, the type of person that you are and the type of role model that you want to be, if you're going to bring on somebody to be a part of your staff, you want them to espouse those same values and be the same type of role model that you are. So can you tell us a little bit about how you've put together your staff, where maybe the background is of the people that you've hired to work with your, to work with your kids, and just what that process is like and how you manage and lead your staff?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I mean, every coach in the program is college graduates. We want our guys to, when we're preaching academics, we want them to know that the guy to your left and the guy to your right has walked the walk that we're asking you to walk. So we want to make sure that we have that in state. Then we have loyalty and respect and just good people. Like, we don't select people to be part of our program based on X and O's from a coaching standpoint. We really recruit guys based on who they are and their morals and being aligned with the vision of making these the best kids possible. We're not even a staff. Like, it's weird because when I say the word staff, I feel like I'm belittling their talent, right? And the people that's next to me. These are literally my brothers, because at this point, you know, the guys that I'm working with every day are people that I go to their baby showers. We go to their weddings. We hang out. We go to double dates. We go to movies. We're like connected, right? These are not just people that I see on the weekend. These are my friends, where everything that we do is connected. So, I mean, I got smart people around me, and I think anyone that understands how to run a business will tell you, hey, surround yourself with people that know more than you, or surround yourself with people that have, you know, they can cover your weaknesses. So while most people look at me and say, hey, this is the leader of the program, it's so broken down to these different departments, where every department has, you know, like a Steph Curry, or this guy's the equivalent of having Kevin Durant. This guy's the equivalent. I might be LeBron, but, you know, I got Chris Paul. Like, everybody that's with me and, you know, that we work together, they're elite at what they do. I always tell people they're bosses. We don't have any yes men, so there's going to always be some tug of war over becoming better, right? We have knockout dragouts because we're trying to get better at our craft. And if we're better at our craft, our kids will become better. So the guys next to me are they're phenomenal. Like, everything they do, if you look at, like, our social media, you look at how we do community service, you look at, you know, how we structure our road trips to our study halls, this is all in-house. Like, we don't hire anybody outside to do our events, to our college recruitment, to our marketing. Like, everything is done inside. Like, we do our own podcast, we do our own interviews. Like, it's literally just, you know, maybe 20 to 25 guys, and everybody's really, really good at what they do.
Yeah, when you can put that together, I think what you said about surrounding yourself with people who are smarter than you, better than you, can fill in your weaknesses, I don't think there's any doubt that as a leader, when you can do that, that allows you to be able to grow exponentially beyond what you might have been able to put together and do yourself.
Hey, coaches, parents, and group leaders. I want to introduce you to our newest sponsor, SnapRaise. SnapRaise is the nation's largest digital donation platform built to help teams, youth groups, and clubs raise money quickly and efficiently without selling products. SnapRaise builds your group a customizable campaign website and students use their mobile devices to connect and engage with their biggest fans. My son's high school team used SnapRaise this season, and our team raised all the money they needed to fund their season, and then some. Getting SnapRaise started is quick and free. Just visit SnapRaise.com, and you'll get connected to a local SnapRaise expert in no time.
So when you start thinking about those people that are part of your team and the impact that they can have on the young people, and just the fact of what you've been able to build, and as you said, keep things in-house, what would you say has been the biggest challenge in terms of being able to do that and keep things in-house and not have to look outside your organization for things that you might have needed, maybe let's say back when you first started? So how have you been able to sort of build this thing out into what it's become, utilizing your staff?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest challenge is if you call it a business, but you're working with family members, right? So, and then when you have family members, you're in a space where things that you want to get done or accomplish in a certain manner, you have to use a certain language, you have to be delicate, or you can just, you know, argue it out, but it's going to somehow affect your friendship, right? So it's not like, hey, if I'm just talking to an assistant coach, I can just tell him, hey, do this and not worry about his feelings. And I'm not the godfather of his son, you know? So I'm in a space where, like, everyone that's here, you know, because they're really good and because we're really connected, we have friendships. So you don't want to lose a friendship based on this. And this is obviously God's work, but it still can't be bigger than the friends that you've had for 15, 16, 20 years. Like the four major guys, the other three major guys in the program went to college together, right? And then, so if you look at our staff, there's been guys who are here 10 years, 8 years, 9 years, 7 years. They've given a lot of sweat and tears to this situation. And ultimately, we want it to feel like it's theirs, but they don't own it, right? It's you're still working to help a bigger cause, but it's not sure. So you got to be respectful of what people bring to the table, be respectful of their feelings, be respectful of their emotions. And one of the biggest things is, as you get older, what used to be fun isn't fun anymore. It becomes somewhat of a job, right? And you don't want to have, like, you got guys who are firefighters and police officers and teachers and, you know, counselors and these guys, you know, construction workers and all these different professions. That's your 9-to-5. You don't want to go to another 9-to-5. This is supposed to be, you know, something that makes you laugh and smile and you feel good inside. So I think the biggest thing is just making sure that it doesn't interfere with the friendship.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense to me. I think that when you're getting and you're putting your staff together, and clearly you have expectations for what you need them to do, what you want them to do, and then they have things that they enjoy, just like you said, they don't want to go and go through the same drudgery that they might feel towards their career, you know, and in their day job. They want to be able to come and be energized by what they do with a basketball program. And I think that's really, really important. When you started this thing and you were beginning to realize that, hey, we've got this group that you started with, and as they started to spread out from winning locally to winning a little bit regionally, and now you start getting involved with Nike and things start happening, at what point do you start to build relationships with college coaches to be able to help your kids to connect with those coaches? In other words, I'm guessing that when you first started that you really didn't have any connections to college coaches. So how did you go about building that network so that you could tap into it to be able to help your kids?
Yeah, I mean, there was times when we were cold calling people or cold emailing random schools. Like, we would literally look up the numbers, look up the emails, email the coaches, send them our roster, send them mixtapes, the guys, send them video, their GPA, their report cards, just everything. Like, you know, we'll draft up an email and basically copy cut paste it, right, to 200 coaches. I mean, as they got older, you know, we were playing on the circuit. So guys were seeing us during the live period. But we were extremely proactive with getting to know coaches or getting to know universities. And, you know, we weren't the best at it yet. Obviously, we were doing it in the beginning. But we didn't have any issues with once we got business cards and we followed up and, you know, we were proactive. We're going after it and want to make sure our kids were all aligned to get to college, because no matter what you do in this game, if the kid doesn't get to college, you failed. Like, that's it. There's no rhyme and reason behind it. There's no excuses. If that parent trusts you to take a kid from 12 to 18 years old and he doesn't make it to school, especially for free, they're looking at every single trip you took and everything you did was just for nothing. So our job has always been, no matter how it has to happen, these kids got to go to school for free. And then we just started building relationships little by little, year after year, year after year, to the point now where we could pretty much get in contact with any college in the country.
Yeah, I believe that. And I clearly, when you have the quality of players that you've been able to come through, we could talk about that here in a little bit, but when you've had the quality of players that you've had to come through the program and you have guys that not only make it to the college level, but eventually make it to the pro level, that tends to give you a lot more credibility in terms of what you're doing and the success that your guys have had moving on through the ranks and being able to do that. Give people an idea of what a player's life is like, or what a day in the life of a player who's part of your program in the summer. Let's say it's during the time when you're playing on the EYBL circuit. Maybe kind of walk us through a week where you're going to have a tournament on the weekend. What does that week look like for your team, your players, for you? What does that look like?
Well, I'll just give you, like, let's say we're preparing for Peace Jam.
Okay.
It'll be maybe four straight days of double practices, and double practices consist of 2 hour practices each on court. There'll be an hour of like off court stuff as far as the track, conditioning, running the track, running the hills, running mountains, anything, ladders, anything that got to do with conditioning, right? Getting them back in shape at that time. It's the beginning of July. You'll have film session for about an hour to go over the stuff that we need to get better at. And then by that time, we'll know the teams that we're playing when we get to Peace Jam. So we'll do film session each practice of the teams that we're going to play and come up with a scouting report. We'll have lunch together. We'll have dinner together. Those guys are all stay at each other's houses in New York, to bond. What else will we do? We'll obviously ice their knees and things of that nature. So a lot of that stuff. And then we might be just doing some community stuff, or, you know, working at a local camp to give back, or, you know, just things that keep us bonded. But we'll spend, I want to say, like 9 o'clock in the morning to like 7 o'clock at night for like 4 or 5 straight days. Just perfecting everything that we needed before we went on that trip. And then, you know, on the trip, it'll be the same type of thing. Study hall, if we need to do anything academically, it'll be ice baths. There's no fast food. The phones will be taken away. We'll do the film sessions. We'll do yoga. We'll do pool workouts. We'll obviously have a bedtime, wake up time, morning runs, just an agenda of everything we need to do that week in order to try to be successful. So, I mean, it really would be, you know, a pretty hectic time for those guys to get to play in front of the college coaches. We'll go 4 or 5 straight days of hard work, like, and then we'll get on the road and try to win the Peace Jam.
What kind of feedback do you get from your players that have gone through the program and then they go to college and they go through their first freshman year of college basketball? And then you have a conversation with them during that season, after that season. What do they tell you in terms of feedback about, hey, but this really prepared me for my first year of college basketball? What are some things that they feel are really beneficial to them in the transition from being a high school basketball player to being a college basketball player?
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends on your level too, right? If we got guys who are going to like the Ivy League, the Patriot League, low major, they're like, this is easy. Like the practices that we are, you know, the practices that we have are harder. If you got guys that's going high major, they're like, the structure that we had on the road is perfect for what I'm going through, because everything is on a schedule and everything is already mapped out for you. And that's kind of like how it is for college. Like when you're traveling and you got to get some reading done on the plane, or, you know, you got the tutors right there at your beck and call. Those guys are excited about that. I think the one negative that they find, and they're a little delusional in the fact that they think the coaching staff are going to love them the way that we love them holistically right away. Right. So yep. We put in a lot of sweat equity with them. So we have this bond and we're able to coach them hard on the court, because they know we love them hard off the court. But they're expecting like their coach, their head coach after practice to be like spending time with them, when the coach is like, no, I got to go to the next thing. So I think they struggle with that. As far as understanding shot selection, minutes played, and how hard you got to play, they're more than prepared. Like our guys, honestly, as freshmen, they're averaging 20 minutes a game, depending on whatever level they go to. They're picking good spots and they're playing right away and they're affecting the game. So the things that we do, like from a practice standpoint, from a technique standpoint, from an expectation standpoint, it aligns itself with a lot of the colleges. And a lot of that comes from us taking college visits to schools and watching practices, or sitting down with coaches and asking them questions about things we can get better at, from sleeping habits to eating habits to film sessions. Like whatever we can do that mimics what they do at the next level, we try to incorporate that more and more each year, so that way the transition is not difficult. But a lot of our guys feel extremely prepared. I mean, obviously the speed of the game is faster, right? And once they really get a chance to attack the weight room, the strength of the game, you know, catches up. But we've been fortunate enough with college coaches are like, listen, he's coachable. He works hard. He's on time. He's ready to work. You can coach him hard. He's not emotional. Like, these are the things that they need you to be ready for. And they're great teammates, right? They understand their job and what they need to do. And they understand production is what keeps you on the court. So, I think a lot of the stuff that we do does translate to the next level. Now, the guys who don't win, there's a psychological warfare with those guys. Like they struggle mightily to handle that, because they're so used to being successful from a winning standpoint. And when they get to college and they lose a couple games in a row, it's not always the easiest thing to deal with.
Which is probably a good thing.
Yeah.
So when you're talking to players and parents while they're still part of your program and having discussions with them about what their college opportunities are going to be, and obviously you have players that play at all different levels that come out of your program. And so clearly one of the things that I think is really key to being a good coach on any level, whether that's an AAU coach, a college coach, a high school coach, is to be able to speak directly and honestly to the players about what it is that, where you think they can play and what level. So how do you approach those conversations with parents and players where maybe the parent and player might have a slightly inflated view of the level that that kid can play at, but you have a much more realistic view because you've gone through the process multiple times with lots and lots of players. So just tell us a little bit about that conversation and what that looks like.
I mean, that conversation has to be led by honesty. I mean, if you think about it, at that time, you're pretty much done with AAU. So what's the worst thing that's going to happen? The parent's not going to say, hey, I don't want to play for you anymore, right?
Right, exactly. So
at this point, you're doing a one-on-one meeting, right? And you're having a conversation to say, hey, listen, I know you might think you're a high major, but here's the schools that are recruiting you, right? And what is the position that you want to be in? Do you want to continue just to wait on something that's not going to come? Throughout my experience, I can tell you the truth. I think your son is a mid-major. I think he should pick the best academic school on this list. And we talk about, what do you want to do after basketball is over? What type of degree do you want to have? Which school has the most minutes for you? What style of play do you fit? Which college, the coaching style, can your kid handle? Like, if you're a kid who can't take yelling, there's a couple schools you don't want to go to, right? It's just, I watch the game. So I think what the place that I come from is I'm coming from a knowledge-based form where I watch a lot of college basketball. So I know way more than them, right? And I just try to position them to understand, like, you know, what's best for now, but what's also best for later, and how is your kid going to be happy? Because there's not a lot of kids who are not playing and they're happy. So happiness is important while you're in college, especially if you're an athlete. So, I mean, it's definitely from a one-on-one standpoint, you're going to have a list. Then the real question comes into, like, when is the best time to commit? You want to have a relationship. You want the school, hopefully, to have a relationship with your AAU program, because you want that school to feel, in a sense, obligated to make sure this kid is in the best arms, because they want to continue to recruit from this program, right? So you don't want to just be out there doing it on your own as a parent or two parents. You want to help. You want to have the programs backing and everyone to be on the same accord. So, I mean, a lot of it is based on what the options are, what the playing time is available. Are you going to win? Because you want to do that. And what type of degree are you looking for?
How do you work with your players, high school coaches, both through the process of as they're coming through their high school career and making sure that you're on the same page with the high school coach? They're not necessarily hearing a different message from each side. And then in terms of the recruiting process, because obviously college coaches are not only talking to you as on the AAU side of it, but they're also talking to the player's high school coach. So what is your philosophy, or how do you build relationships with your player's high school coach to make sure that you're on the same page and that everybody's kind of working and pulling in the same direction?
Yeah. I mean, we spend a lot of time, like, visiting our guys. Like, if you're in prep schools, we'll come up and visit, you know, just regular day and not necessarily watch basketball, but we'll sit down and talk to the college coach. I mean, the high school coach about, you know, what schools he's looking at, what schools he might want to look at. And we'll ask their opinion, like, hey, what do you think? And if they say the same thing we're saying, we'll be like, okay, cool. Like, this is easy, you know? And then if they're like, hey, nah, I think he should look at this school, this school, and this school, I'm like, all right, well, can you explain why? And then you explain your side, he'll explain his side, and you try to get on the same accord, at least for a couple of schools, because you don't want the parents feeling like the high school coach is pulling them one way, the AAU coach is pulling them another way. It could just get messy. So I think we have a really good relationships with all of the high schools that our guys are at. And honestly, the high school coaches, they don't really, really get too far involved with the kids' recruitments for the most part, at least, you know, the guys that's in our program. But I think the other thing is relationship building. Is majority of the kids that they're help being placed at these schools. So the coach is more so saying, hey, you guys can take care of that. I'll just coach them in high school and make sure you're doing well academically. And then you guys can lead that, usher in that situation with the recruitment process. And some parents do everything on themselves. Some parents are like, hey, we need your help. It's not a bunch of schools that our guys are at that their high school coaches are saying, hey, I'm going to be the person that says you should go to school X. Like, it's more of a joint venture, you know?
Do you think that was something that you had to build over time in terms of building your trust and credibility compared to maybe, let's say, when you started? I'm sure that process is a lot easier now that high school coaches have seen that you have the player's best interest at heart. Because, you know, there's always that controversy between high school coaches and AAU. You hear it's out there that, you know, each side kind of complains about some of the things about the other. But I think what I'm hearing you say and what I've seen with programs that are successful, both talking about high school programs and AAU programs, is there's that communication back and forth. And when you have that proactive communication, now you have trust. And it seems to me that as you've gone along, that you've been able to build that trust with both coaches at the high school level and coaches at the college level.
Yeah. I mean, I think for one thing I know is that people don't like pressure, right? The high school coaches don't really want the pressure of that kid not getting to school, right? Or that kid being at your high school for 4 years and not going to the Division I school. So AAU does a lot of heavy lifting because of the amount of exposure that we have. So guys are getting offers at a high frequent rate during the AAU seasons because there's such a high number of coaches at the games. So I think what happens is high school coaches are like, oh, no, I'm not going to put up a big argument about this as long as the kid is going to school for free, because we all look like we did our jobs, you know. And I think our relationship and our reputation is kind of like, hey, these guys help place the kid in prep schools, then they help place the kid in college. Like, they do so much of the work for you that there's a clean line of understanding what your role is and what my role is and our role is as an AAU side. Like, we need you to make sure the kid has a safe haven to become academically sound. His grades are on par. His SAT score is headed in the right direction. We'll help with that stuff. But ultimately, these are the things that you need to cover, and these are the things that we need to cover. But then we communicate during the year where it's like, hey, you know, this school is coming in to see kid X, or this school is really interested in him. This school wants to offer him. But there's no egos. I think as long as the egos are left at the door, you're fine. Because ultimately, we're both working together because the kid needs to go to school. If the kid doesn't go to school, we both failed, right? So, like, this year we're going to go 12 for 12 in Division One. Like, all 12 of those kids might go to different high schools, but all of their coaches are like, hey, you guys did a phenomenal job doing COVID. You know what I mean? Like, there was no basketball. And if you're, let's say you're in high school today, and you don't know what your season is going to look like, but your number one player is committed already, you're happy, right?
For sure.
So you don't care if he chose Oregon or Alabama. You just know this kid is done, and I could sleep better at night, right? So we're all working together to help that end goal. And as long as you're dealing with people that understand that, like, the transition is not that difficult. And we try our best to stay away from high schools that don't want to assist in that process and making sure this kid has the most opportunities possible for college. Like, if it's just about winning for them, we try to get away from that school.
Well, I think what I hear you saying, I think this is something that's the hallmark of any good program, is it has to be about the kid first. And when it's about the kid first, you as the adult, if you're putting the kid's best interest ahead of your own best interest, then that's when you're going to end up getting the best results. And that is what builds more trust and more credibility and allows you to attract more players and be able to have a bigger impact. And I think it just kind of feeds on itself. I want to give you a chance to name drop a little bit, and just, I'm going to ask you this question. And that is, some of the guys that you've been able to help get their career jump-started and they eventually make it to the NBA, can you point to, you can share some names, but also then just maybe point to some things that you feel separate those guys from, because obviously people who are playing in your program, the kids who are playing in your program are all high-level kids, and they're all kids that are great basketball players. But if you're going to make it to the league, you have to be a cut above. You have to have something different. So in your experience, what's some things that set apart those kids that are truly the elite of the elite?
Yeah, so I'll go by the names, and then I'll kind of like try to go backwards.
Sure.
So you got Chris McCullough. He was drafted by the Nets. You got Terry Laria. He had a stint with the Clippers. You have Thomas Bryant. I think he's with the Wizards now, Washington. You have Shaq Diallo. He's with Phoenix. You have Omari Spellman. He's with Minnesota. You have Mo Bamba, who's with Orlando. You have Ty Jerome, who's with Phoenix. You have Cole Anthony on his way. I think that's like 7 or 8, right? So I think what separated a lot of the guys with the size was the fact that they could stretch the court. So if you look at McCullough at 6'9", 6'10", he could shoot the three. You look at Thomas, same thing, 6'10", he could shoot the three. You look at Omari Spellman, 6'9", 6'10", he could shoot the three. And then Mo Bamba, 7 feet, he could shoot the three. And then what happened with Diallo was his motor, right? Where he was just fearless with the amount of energy that he played with. So, and he was productive. so no one's turned down production, right? Like no matter how you do it, it was getting done, right? And then I think what separated Ty Jerome from the pack was his elite size for a point guard at 6'5", and his shot, his ability to shoot from range, but most importantly, his IQ, like his feel for the game, his understanding of the game, all of those things. So, and then obviously being at Virginia and winning and, you know, the NCAA tournament run, that helped him. Like, we've had two guys win national championships. I think the last two national championships have been PSA kids, Amari Spellman at Villanova and Ty Jerome at Virginia. And then obviously Cole's going to get drafted. I think just his competitive nature was something that separated him from his entire class in the 2019 group. So, I mean, that's pretty much how their makeups were. But just guys who had the moons and the stars aligned for them, man, and they made it to the highest level, you know, and they're fortunate.
Absolutely. All right. I want to ask you one final question. It's a two-parter, and it's a question.
Go one part at a time.
One part at a time. All right. So this is the question that I've been kind of trying to wrap up our shows with lately, because I think it kind of gets to the heart of why we all do what we do. So part one is, what is the biggest challenge as you look forward with the PSA Cardinals? What is the biggest challenge that you see? Forget about COVID. Let's just imagine that things get back to normal. Let's cross our fingers and hope that that happens. What do you see as being the biggest challenge to be able to continue to sustain the success you've had and continue to grow what you've built?
Yeah, the biggest challenge, one is is a couple. I'll say this. One is making sure that us as a unit, as far as the adults that are entrusted in making sure these young men try to reach their goals, have enough energy, right? And fire in our stomach to continue to do the best job we can, not slack off, not take days off, or not become complacent with the level that we're at today. Like, find a way to continue to become even better. That's the first thing. The second challenge, I think, is a community-based challenge where I'm trying to get us to be considered the program that's the program of the entire New York City community, right? Where the resources and things that everyone needs, we can help provide those resources in some form or fashion, where it's not like our structure, our deal, like our house is open, right, to everyone that we can help in some form or fashion. And in line with that, getting the ultimate thing is getting the respect from New York City, in my opinion, the way that we got respect from around the country. So, in saying that, if you ask people around the country their opinion of PSA, they'll say stuff like, man, they're one of the top five programs in the country, top 10 at minimum. But if you ask Billy from down the street, he'll say they're not.
It's so funny you say that, because I have seen that play out. I had somebody actually, I was on a phone call with a guy, and his quote was, and it dovetails perfectly what you just said. He said, it's hard to be the expert in your hometown. And when he said that, I was like, man, that is profound. And that is exactly what you just described. So interesting, very interesting answer.
Yeah. It's based on competition, though. The people next to you are in competition with you. So you will almost have to let your guard down to accept love or give the flowers to someone that they deserve before they pass away, but take away competition so you can do that. But because they're so caught up in competition, it's hard to say this person is really good at this. Like, I've had conversations with people where you can give them legitimate factors that said, we're better than you at something, right? Like, in mathematics, if someone said, hey, I put 82 kids in college in 8 years, and you put 40 kids in college in 8 years, everyone in America will say, well, this program is better at putting kids in college than you are, right? But someone would say, no, 40 is higher than the 80. Because they're in competition, so they can't admit that. So it's just a weird, it's a weird dynamics. But you want to end, you want to end the situation on a note that says you get the same amount of respect in home as you got around the country. That's like one of our, my challenges.
Excellent. Excellent answer. Makes complete sense to me. I can totally relate to what you just said. All right. Second part of the question is your biggest joy. So when you get out of bed in the morning, yeah, what makes you excited to come into work every single day and get to do what you do?
My biggest joy, honestly, is that I'm working, I'm working with friends, and I have the ability to manipulate time. So like I'm a, if anybody knows me, they'll tell you like this guy doesn't do alarm clocks, but he's always on time and he's always doing everything minute by minute or hour by hour. But I'm a self-motivated person. So having this, this non-for-profit, having this organization allows me not to have to deal with a lot of red tape or people trying to tell me what to do. Like I have options, right? I have options with my time as much as I can. So as adults, we want as much time to ourselves as we can get, but we ultimately have to work 8 hours a day for the most part. So I'm able to steal time at the end of the day. And time is the most valuable commodity in the world at this point to me. So I'm able, that's the biggest thing. When I get out the bed, I know that if I just handle everything the way I need to handle it, I'm going to be able to steal time from the universe.
Makes sense to me. I think you're 100% spot on with the fact that we all could use more time. I know that I could use 26 hours in a day for sure. I'd have plenty to do in those other 2 hours. Trust me, Terrence. Trust me when I say that. All right. Before we wrap up, I want to give you a chance to share where people can find out more about your program, find out more about you and what you guys are doing with the PSA Cardinals. And then after you do that, I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Yeah, man. PSA Cardinals on Twitter, PSA Cardinals on Instagram. Follow the website, PSA Cardinals. And if you really want to know, like we like to tell our own stories. You can find somebody that knows somebody that knows somebody, and they can get you my phone number. And then you'll get all the answers you want.
There you go. Done. All right. Terrence, we cannot thank you enough for spending an hour and 20 minutes or so with us tonight and sharing your story, which, again, I think there was a lot of things in there that coaches and basketball people can take from it and learn. And clearly, when you talk about education, that's always a subject that Jason and I are passionate about. And clearly, you're passionate about it as well. And yes, we cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us. It's been an absolute pleasure getting a chance to know you and have this conversation. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
If you have an existing podcast or are looking to launch your own pod but aren't sure where to start, the team at My Podcast Manager can help. Our podcast team works behind the scenes so you can do what you do best. We'll help you launch your podcast, make it sound great, and free up your time for the more enjoyable parts of podcasting. If you're ready to put your podcast editing, production, and promotion on autopilot with a trusted team of podcasting professionals, visit mypodcastmanager.com to get started.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.